Okay, I want you to close your eyes for a second. Engage your mind's eye.
Right.
Imagine you are standing on the very peak of a high mountain. The air is thin, it's crisp, and the silence up there is just absolute. You look down over the edge and spread out across this massive plain below you, something that looks like the entire world is a military
A
force.
huge one.
So vast, it literally stretches to the curve of the horizon.
It's a staggering image. And it's not just some chaotic crowd, right? There is a distinct structure to what you're seeing.
Exactly. It's the spectacle that hits you first. You see these brilliant flashes of lightning, but then you realize it's not a storm.
It's the armor.
It's sunlight hitting acres of polished silver armor. You hear a sound that shakes your chest like rolling thunder, but it's the rhythmic tread of millions of boots hitting the earth, all in unison.
It's terrifying, but also beautiful in a way.
It is.
And what you are describing is the opening scene from a text called The Vision of the Three Armies by Rick Joyner. It's a piece of allegorical literature that paints a very vivid picture of the spiritual state of a massive movement.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to take a guided tour of this vision. We're not just going to skim the surface. We are going to walk through the ranks.
Inspect the troops.
Yeah, inspect the troops from the glittering vanguard at the front to
Yeah.
the chaotic mob dragging up the rear. We need to understand what makes them tick, how they impact the world around them, and the ultimate diagnosis the text offers about leadership and character.
And I think it's crucial to frame this right from the start. While the imagery is very, high fantasy swords, shields, banners,
Right.
the text is really a study in organizational psychology. It's looking at order versus chaos, selflessness versus ambition, and it asks a very hard question. What does it actually mean to be ready for a battle?
So let's zoom in. The narrator is on this mountain looking down. He starts by focusing on the very front of the line, the vanguard. This is the first army. Give us the visual profile here. What are we looking at?
Visually, this is the elite unit, the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
And interestingly, it's by far the smallest group. We're told there are 12 divisions, but the description is just pristine.
Pristine is a good word.
Every soldier is wearing armor of polished silver. They carry these shields that seem to be made of pure gold.
And the banners. You can't miss the banners.
No, you can't. They're carrying these massive banners, 30 to 40 feet long. I mean, just think about the physics
Oh,
of
the
that.
strength required.
Right. Holding a 40-foot banner while marching, it implies this immense strength, and they're just snapping in the wind.
The text really emphasizes the sensory impact here. It says their armor flashed like lightning and their footsteps. They sounded like thunder.
It's designed to be intimidating.
But, and this is where it gets really interesting, when the narrator zooms in on their faces, the vibe isn't scary warrior. It's not bloodthirsty berserker.
No, it's much more nuanced and frankly more unsettling because of that nuance.
Oh.
The text describes their faces as having a fierce resolution, but at the same time, a profound peace.
That is such a tricky combination. Usually, if you're fiercely resolute, you're tense. Your jaw is clenched, adrenaline is spiking, you're on edge.
Precisely. But here, the text explicitly says they did not seem tense. They were marching toward a war,
Yeah.
yet not a single one feared the battle.
Which suggests a level of internal confidence that goes way beyond just physical training or good equipment. They aren't psyching themselves up.
They're just ready.
And this internal state, it bleeds into the whole culture of this first army. The text describes it as having this unprecedented discipline, like perfect marching order, yet it feels like a big family.
That paradox is key. Usually, high discipline means a rigid, cold hierarchy. But here, we see generals and high-ranking officers marching right there in the ranks with the lower officers.
No VIP section.
Exactly. No separation of management and labor.
I loved that detail. It mentions that while it was obvious who was in charge, probably just by their bearing, nobody was overly sensitive to their rank.
That is the critical differentiator. I mean,
Right.
think about almost any human hierarchy, corporate, military, political. There's almost always a jockeying for position. Why did she get the promotion? Why is his title better than mine?
Sure.
But here, the narrator notes that he just couldn't detect any ambition or pride.
But the text makes a really specific point about that selflessness. I think this is important so we don't misunderstand it. It wasn't that they were just drones who had lost their identity.
It's the exact opposite. The
Yeah.
text says they were selfless because they were so sure of who they were. And that is a massive insight into human nature. The idea that true humility comes from security, not insecurity.
Because they knew their identity, they knew their mission.
They didn't need to use their rank to prove anything, they were secure.
So that's the gold standard, the First Army. Secure, disciplined, peaceful, powerful. But then the narrator shifts his gaze. He looks past this glittering front line, and the view changes. A lot.
Yeah, we enter the middle ground. The Second Army.
And this group is much, much larger. Hundreds of divisions.
And let's be fair, at first glance, if you hadn't just seen the First Army, you'd think this was an awesome force. Just the scale of it. It's a wall of humanity.
True. But the quality. It begins to dip immediately. The visuals get a little duller here, don't they? The 4K resolution drops a bit.
It does. They have banners, but they aren't those majestic 40-foot ones. They're smaller, they have uniforms, but the text notes that many soldiers don't have a full set of armor.
Some don't even have weapons.
Right. And the armor they do have, it's not polished to that mirror finish we saw. It's functional, but it's not radiant.
But they are still marching. They still have a purpose. It's not like they've given up.
They haven't given up, no. In fact, the narrator says they have determination and devotion, maybe even more than any earthly army. They want to be there. Mm-hmm. But the key missing ingredient is focus.
Focus.
They lack the singular vision of the first group.
So what's distracting them? If they're devoted, why aren't they polished?
It's social dynamics. Specifically, rank and status. Unlike the first group, where the generals marched happily with the privates, here, the soldiers are hyper-aware of their own rank.
And the rank of those around them.
Exactly. The text specifically mentions ambition and jealousy just percolating in the ranks.
You know, it's interesting how the text frames ambition here. In our world, in a corporate context, we usually see ambition as a virtue. It's drive.
It's what pushes you to succeed, sure.
Yeah.
But here, in this context of a unified mission, ambition turns the focus inward. Instead of looking at the goal, you're looking sideways at your peer, wondering, why is his stripe bigger than mine, or I should be leading this division? It splits your attention.
It just dilutes the collective power. So we have the elite vanguard, the distracted but capable Second Army, and then we look way, way back to the Third Army, the mob.
And this is where the image becomes truly dystopian. This group is massive. Millions upon millions. They're so far behind they can barely even see the banners of the vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
And the visual description is, well, it's grim.
Tattered, dull gray uniforms. Dirty. Unpressed.
It looks less like an army and more like a refugee crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Or a riot.
And the detail that stood out to me was that they are injured. The text says almost everyone was bloody and wounded, but they haven't even reached the battle yet.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they fighting?
That's the tragedy of the Third Army. The wounds are self-inflicted.
They're fighting each other.
Yes. Fights are constantly breaking out. It describes their movement not like a disciplined column, but like a great flock of birds just sweeping erratically left and right. They're drifting.
Total chaos. And when you look at the leadership structure described, it all starts to make sense.
It's a completely broken system. In this massive group, there are only two ranks. Generals and privates.
No middle management, no sergeants, no captains to bridge that gap.
Just a massive gulf between the leaders and the led.
Let's talk about those generals. The text has a detail about their equipment that felt almost like a political cartoon.
You mean the dummy weapons?
Yes. That just blew my mind.
It's a biting critique, isn't it? The generals flaunt these fake weapons to look special, to look important, but everyone knows they aren't real.
They have no cutting power.
These leaders are described as self-appointed. They spend their time talking about themselves and fighting with one another. There's absolutely no care for the troops.
And the troops, the privates, they seem desperate. The narrator says they want to find someone real to follow, but they're just stuck.
They're stuck in this drifting mass of confusion.
Yeah.
And here is the brutal strategic assessment the text offers. This Third Army, despite having millions of people, actually weakens the overall force.
That was a shock to read. Usually, numbers equal strength. But the text says sustaining them, feeding them. It costs more than any fighting value they add. They're a liability.
The quote is quite stinging. A private in the first or second group would be worth more than many generals from the third.
Wow.
It completely dismantles the idea that headcount equals power. Here, numbers without discipline. They just equal vulnerability.
So we've scrutinized the soldiers, we've seen the silver vanguard, the distracted middle, and the gray mob. But the vision shifts perspective here in a really interesting way.
Yeah, it stops looking at the people and starts looking at the ground beneath their feet.
The environmental impact, if you will.
This is crucial to the allegory. It's essentially the principle of, you know, by their fruits you will know them. The narrator watches what happens to the land after each army passes. It's the trail of evidence.
So the first army, the Silver and Gold Group, passes through a dry, dusty plain. What happens?
Total restoration.
Yeah.
It's magical. The earth turns dark green, trees start bearing fruit instantly, pure streams start flowing where there was just dust.
They leave the earth better than they found it.
The text says they are restoring the earth, which is the opposite of what a normal army does, historically.
A locust swarm.
Exactly. They are life givers. Then the second army come through. Now, they don't destroy everything, but they diminish it. They leave the bridges standing, but the streams get muddied. The grass isn't quite as green.
It's a mediocrity.
It's mediocrity. They maintain the structure, but the quality of life drops.
And
then the third army rolls through.
Devastation.
Absolute ruin. They undo the good work of the first two groups. Grass is trampled into mud. Trees are stripped bare. Streams are polluted. Bridges are broken. The buildings are left in shambles.
And remember, this isn't an enemy force. This is supposedly the friendly army.
That's what triggers the emotional climax of the vision. The narrator watches this and he gets angry. He's indignant. And then he realizes that Wisdom, the character representing the Lord in this text, is standing beside him, and he is angry too.
Wisdom drops a heavy line here. Selfishness destroys.
That is the core diagnosis. The chaotic destruction of the Third Army isn't because they're evil villains in the traditional sense. It's because they are selfish.
They claim the name, they show up, they put on the uniform.
Even if it's tattered, but they don't walk in the ways of the leader. They're internally disconnected.
This leads us to a specific and slightly intense biblical reference. The text brings up the story of Zipporah. Now, for the listener who might not be a biblical scholar, this is a pretty obscure passage. Why bring this up?
It is obscure, but in this context, it's vital. The story in Exodus involves Moses being threatened with death by the Lord until his wife, Zipporah, circumcises their son. It's a very raw, ancient, and honestly a quite jarring story.
Very.
But the text interprets this as a metaphor for the circumcision of the heart.
So let's decode that. Moving away from the physical, what does circumcision of the heart imply in this leadership context?
It's talking about cutting away the carnal nature, or to put it simply, the ego, the pride, the selfishness we just discussed. The narrator realizes that the army cannot march any further without this internal surgery. They keep going with the selfishness. They won't just be ineffective. They'll be destroyed by the Lord himself. Because they're destroying the land in his name.
It's a call for radical internal discipline. It's saying you can't just put on the uniform. You have to change the operating system of the heart.
Right. The narrator actually cries out, Lord, raise up those with the wisdom of Zipporah. It's a desperate plea to stop the fake, showy behavior, the dummy weapons, the self-appointed titles, and get down to the painful, necessary work of character formation.
So things look pretty bleak for the Third Army. It feels hopeless. But Wisdom, the guide, starts to explain the future. He calls himself the captain of the host. What's the solution? How do you fix a mob of millions?
Well, first, Wisdom reveals a hard truth. What the narrator saw in the First Army, that glorious silver vanguard, is actually the future potential.
Okay.
But the reality right now, he says, almost the entire army is currently the condition of that third group.
Oof. So the mob is the status quo. That is a sobering reality check.
It is. But the solution involves a leadership purge and a strategic shift. Wisdom says that the self-appointed generals, the ones with the dummy weapons, are not real.
Right.
And here's the kicker. Most of them will flee as soon as the actual battle starts. Their courage is fake. They're LARPing.
LARPing war. Wow. So who fills that vacuum when the fake generals run away?
New leaders. The text calls them shepherds after my own heart. It likens them to King David.
Yeah.
These are people who are currently humble, serving faithfully in small tasks, not seeking position.
They're not trying to be famous. They're trying to be faithful.
Exactly. They're the ones actually taking care of the sheep while the others are arguing over titles.
And once these new leaders are in place, there's a strategic shift. And I think this is my favorite part of the text because it is so counterintuitive.
Oh, yeah.
The army has to learn to camp.
Yes. This is profound. In a military context, or even a modern productivity context, we are obsessed with marching, moving forward, taking ground.
Hitting Q4 goals, we feel like if we aren't moving, we're failing.
But the text argues that camping is just as important as marching.
But camping sounds so passive, it sounds like doing nothing. A delay. What happens in the camp?
Everything that matters. The camp is for training, it's for equipping, it's for sharpening skills, it's where the circumcision of the heart happens, it's where you fix the internal issues so you don't destroy the external environment later. Wisdom says a line that everyone should write down. The strength of the army that marches will be determined by the quality of its camp.
That is such a quotable line. The strength of the army that marches will be determined by the quality of its camp. It completely flips the script on patience.
It reframes waiting, or stopping, not as wasted time, but as the most critical phase of the mission.
If you march before you camp, you are just a mob.
Exactly. If you camp well, you become the vanguard. The text envisions a time when the third group ceases to exist entirely. People are either disciplined into becoming true soldiers, or they're dispersed.
So the goal isn't just to make the mob slightly better. The goal is the eradication of the mob mentality itself.
An army that is holy, disciplined, and victorious. That's the vision. It ends with a promise that when the army finally marches under this true, humble leadership, after the camping, after the training, they won't destroy the earth. They will give life.
They will become that first army we saw at the beginning.
Turning the dust into fruit.
It's a powerful arc. We started with the glitter and the thunder of the first army, waded through the mud and confusion of the mob, and we ended up with a roadmap for how to get from one to the other.
And it all comes down to internal discipline and the willingness to stop and camp. It really challenges our definitions of success. Success isn't just movement or noise or numbers.
It's character.
Success is the ability to restore rather than destroy.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the vision of the three armies, we want to leave you with something to chew on in your own life.
We talked about camping. We live in a world that is just obsessed with forward motion. Career progression, news cycles, the constant scroll. We feel guilty if we aren't marching. We feel like we're falling behind.
But the text suggests that if you march without being ready, you're just a mob creating chaos. So here's the question. What would camping look like in your life right now? Is the delay you're frustrated by, that promotion you didn't get, that door that didn't open, is that actually the most important part of your mission? Maybe it's time to stop marching and sharpen the sword.
A provocative thought indeed. Sometimes the fastest way forward is to stop.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.